Coffee and Chromosomes is brought to you by the charity Wouldn't Change a Thing, creating a world where negative perceptions of Down syndrome are a thing of the past. If you would like to hear more about a certain topic or even from a particular individual, then please get in touch with us. Email us at podcast@wouldn'tchangeathing.org and we'll do our best to try and make it happen. Hello and welcome to another episode of Coffee and Chromosomes. Today we are lucky to be joined by Dr. Liz Herivan, who is a consultant in emergency medicine and paediatric emergency medicine. Not only a doctor, Liz is also mum to two children. She has a daughter Amy and son Toby. Hi Liz, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. Nice to speak to you both.
So Liz, what would be a good place to start is just to tell us a little bit about yourself and about your family.
Okay, cool. So I am a doctor working in the A&E department in Hull. I look after children mostly. We've lived here for about 20 years. I live with my husband, Paul, and our two children, Amy and Toby. Amy's 15. She loves Ed Sheeran. She loves sleepovers. She likes packing for sleepovers. She likes baking. She doesn't like being told what to do. And she has Down syndrome and is autistic. She's given me a real special interest in health inequalities, in looking at things from the other side, really. I was a doctor for many years before she came along, and it felt really odd all of a sudden being thrown into that other side of things. So she's taught me an awful lot, both as a mum and as a doctor, I think.
And so going back to, you know, those early years of Amy's life, tell us a little bit about her journey.
So right back at the beginning, on our very first ultrasound scan, there were signs that she might have some kind of genetic or chromosomal problem. The sonographer noted a few different things. And at the time, I didn't want any testing. I thought it wasn't going to make any difference to anything I did. So we just kept going back for repeat ultrasounds. And they noticed more and more things as we went along. They sent us for an MRI at one point to get some more information, more detail. And when we got to about 20 weeks, they said to me that they thought it was very likely that she had Edwards syndrome. And I think at that point, I just needed to know one way or the other what was going on so that I could prepare myself. I didn't know what I would do with that information, but I just needed to know the information.
Yeah.
So I said, fine, I give in. I'll have the amnio. And they were fab. We did it straight away that day. And I remember having a phone call about 3 days later with the results. And the lady on the phone said, right, I've got the results for you. And I'm afraid to tell you that she has Down syndrome. And I just went, oh, thank God, because I knew more about Down syndrome than anything else. And I thought, I can do this. They called us in for a chat and there was lots of information about what to do if we decided not to continue with the pregnancy. There was very little information about what to do if we wanted to carry on. And I already knew we wanted to carry on. We just needed to know what that meant and what we'd need to prepare for, what sort of things we could do to make that as straightforward as possible, really.
Of course, yeah.
So I went away and tackled it the way that I tackle most things, is try and find out as much information as I could. And I think having that time between diagnosis and when she was born gave me that kind of window to prepare myself, yeah. But also to prepare the people around me as well, because I was able to tell people in my own time what was happening, which was an interesting experience. It was a mix of some people shrugging their shoulders and saying, oh, so what? And other people going, oh my God. And people, I think me being able to do that gradually in a controlled kind of way probably helped me to get my head around things as well, I think. And then we got to 30 weeks and she decided she'd had enough. She was coming out.
Oh, wow.
So she was born at 30 weeks and the biggest issues, to be honest, when she was tiny were all to do with her being premature.
Yeah.
There were no real specific Down syndrome issues to worry about. We were in hospital for about 8 weeks, which was just a long, horrible, soul-destroying process. And I think everything felt very medicalized purely because of the fact she was so early, I think.
Yeah.
And I didn't really get time during that period to think about the impact that Down syndrome had on her or on us, because it was all about how small she was.
Yeah.
Then the next couple of years, really, she was in and out of hospital constantly. She had bronchiolitis, she had pneumonia, she had sepsis, she had heart operations, she had hip problems. And so it was just a roller coaster of issues. The biggest one being she was 2 years old and she got chickenpox. And I remember thinking, chickenpox is a you know, really common illness, one more to tick off the list. Mm. But a couple of days later, she was just so poorly, and she'd actually developed infection in her lungs as a result of the chicken pox. So was really poorly. She was airlifted across the country by helicopter over to Alderhay and spent a week in intensive care, and just a horrible, horrible period of time for all of us. But I think having got through that, anything else that we've had to tackle, whether it be, you know, behavioural issues or, you know, puberty, which has been a challenge. I think having got through that big, big episode, I think we feel that we can tackle most things.
Yeah. I think that's quite a key theme, isn't it? I think once you've had something huge that you think, how are we ever going to?
Yeah. And you do, you get through things, don't you? One way or the other. Yeah. It just feels impossible at the time, I think.
And so being obviously in pediatrics, has at that time when you were going through all of that, did that help your journey or did it hinder? It was almost worse knowing it all, I guess, as a doctor, but then not being in control of her care when she's unwell.
Yeah, I really struggled with not being in control. I'm a bit of a control freak. And I think that was really challenging, knowing that it wasn't up to me. It was up to those around me, and I had to trust other people. But the other issue was that I didn't know as much as people thought I did. People would assume that I was thinking along the same lines as them, would assume that I'd seen the same information. And so there were lots of kind of half conversations where people would tell me things and I'd think, is that what they really meant? You know, they're assuming that I know things. And I think my husband, who's not medical, really struggled because he was kept out of a lot of conversations. Yeah. And he'd say to me afterwards, what on earth was all of that about?
Yeah.
I know when she was really poorly and with the chickenpox episode, I think my initial coping mechanism was to go into doctor mode for that bit. And when she was intubated, I reached out for a stethoscope so I could listen to her chest. And my, it's actually one of my colleagues that intubated her, and he said, put that down, you're her mum. Right. And he was completely right, but it was really difficult, I think, to separate those two sides of things.
Of course.
I think it taught me a huge amount though about the things that parents go through, and you don't necessarily feel that otherwise, I think. And since then, I think when I've seen really sick kids, it's reminded me how it felt for me to go through that. And I hope that that's helped a bit.
Yeah.
Because when you mentioned the conversation that you had once you got the diagnosis, or you knew what you're expecting and the options that were given to you, how was that conversation thinking about, like, you know, you're in the profession and a lot of it is about how you communicate that information. How did you feel that was?
I think they did as good a job as they could with the information that they had. Right. And I think one of the issues that we struggle with all the time is that people just don't have the information to give. They don't know what it's like to have a child with Down syndrome. You know, why test for something if we're not going to look at it as being bad? You know, it's a risk, isn't it? And it's all that kind of language and terminology and the knowledge that people genuinely don't have. And I think if they haven't experienced that world and they haven't been shown what it's like, then it's very difficult for them to have a proper conversation balancing things out. And I think that information is really key to making decisions.
Yeah.
I'd already made my mind up, so it was only going to go one way. But I can imagine if I hadn't, there wasn't much there to encourage me to think about the benefits. Yeah.
And do you think, obviously through the years and being in the medical profession, obviously there are lots of great charities out there now. There are great social media accounts, etc., out there, books. A lot of people are talking about it. Sometimes I worry we get in a bit of an echo chamber and we talk to, you know, the same kind of preaching to the converted almost. But in terms of balancing that view, what's it like on the medical side? Do you feel that voices are being heard? Do you feel changes are being made? I know obviously we still have got a way to go, but how's that changed, do you think, over the years?
I think we've got a really long way to go, unfortunately. And there are lots of really good organisations, as you say, chipping away at things. But it is just chipping away. It's really difficult to get that momentum going, I think. I think perhaps one of the differences at the moment is that more people are aware of the issues and aware that they should know more. And so they're more likely to seek out more information. Whereas I think when Amy was born and certainly before that, people just weren't aware that it was even something they should know more about. So I think we're getting there, but I think we've still got a really long way to go. Yeah. I do a lot of work around access to healthcare and serious illness in our kids and in others with learning disability. And none of what I say is rocket science. It's all about listening to parents and finding out what the child is like when they're well, yeah, which should be something that we do for all patients. But I think we forget because we're busy. We know what we're doing. We're in our role. We're in our system and we just keep going and we don't stop to think about the simple things that can make a huge difference.
Yeah, I think so. I think in our experience, so we've got Kush and we've got two daughters, Kira and Shaylee, who are typical children. And I think we've noticed over the years, and it was only since having the girls, that when Kush is unwell or falling ill, mm-hmm, we don't get the signs that we would get with the girls. He could be absolutely fine, overcompensating sometimes, and you think, oh my gosh, what's got into him? Yep. And then that night he'll crash, he'll have a ridiculous fever, or he can't breathe, and we've got to be in A&E literally hours after he's gone to bed. So we've obviously, as his parents, have learned to pick up on a few of those signs, as subtle as they are. And I mean, I'm quite vocal. So is Hamill to a certain extent as well. But as in when we're in front of, we had a lot of time in hospital when Kush was young. And I guess I'm not scared to challenge and have conversations. Whereas sometimes I feel we need to tell our parents to shout a bit louder, because as much as we obviously need to rely on medical professions, sometimes exactly what you said, it is a little bit different. And doctors do need to listen to parents, especially when it comes to children who have, you know, learning difficulties or complex needs. You know, is that something that you would encourage parents to do?
Absolutely. And it's a real sad fact that we have to do that, I think. And those that shout the loudest get heard. I think one of the problems is that we don't get much at all in medical training about difference, whether that be Down syndrome or whether that be autism or whether that be anything else, really. Mm. I remember one lecture only on Down syndrome, and that was about having a single palm of crease and, you know, extra chromosome and stuff. It was nothing practical, nothing that I could ever use. Yeah. And I think a lot of the issues are seen as more of a social problem rather than a health problem. Right. But those social problems will have an impact on access to healthcare. Yeah. And I think there's very little knowledge out there about how our children are different when they're ill. The fact that they will get sick quickly, the fact that they don't always have the same signs, that they're getting sick. And I think for medical professionals, if you don't know that there is a difference, you can't learn about that difference. And yeah, so we've got to start right back at basics and say, you know, yes, we love our children to be included. We like to say that there is no difference. They're part of society. But we have to be realistic to say that in certain cases, there are differences and you need to know about them. And that's kind of been some of the stuff that I've been banging on about for the past few years.
So you've done a lot of work, haven't you, to change this and to fill the gaps in doctors' knowledge in respect to treating children or young adults with complex needs. So, yeah, tell us why. Well, you've told us a lot about why you've done what you've done, but tell us what you've done and how you think that's helped.
So mostly it's been trying to get my foot in the door in as many different places as I can, talking at conferences, locally initially and then nationally, and very grateful to be able to talk internationally on a couple of occasions as well. Writing blogs and articles and things and just trying to get stuff out there that is accessible to as many different health professionals as possible, doctors, nurses, allied health professionals, podcasts. and then the real big starter for a lot of that and something that's still really being shared widely and which I'm really grateful for is a poster aimed at initially emergency physicians, but any clinicians really, talking about how to assess our children and some of the differences that are out there. It came about through a Twitter conversation. A Twitter conversation was had around two really sad cases from Leicester, where two young boys had both presented at different times and both ended up dying of sepsis. And there were various steps along those pathways that perhaps could have been picked up on a little bit earlier if people had known about the differences that our children have. And we were in this Twitter conversation and I realized that actually all the other people in the conversation did not have the benefit that I did of having a living, breathing example at home that's taught me so much. So we started listing some of those main differences and put them together in a poster format to try and help to share that information. So things like the fact that our children don't always control their temperature very well. They don't control their circulation very well. They get sick really quickly when they're going to do it. They might not have normal symptoms and signs that other kids might have. The fact that communication is such a key part of everything we do. And, you know, we ask for translators all the time if we're talking to somebody whose first language isn't English, but we don't think about how to communicate with people that have a speech and language delay. It's all these really, really key things that actually, again, aren't rocket science, but that we don't learn about. And so we put that together to try and spread some awareness and to help pick up on some of these key issues so that hopefully our children have a bit of a fighting chance when they are ill, somebody picking things up.
And is that poster, is that for medical professionals or is it for parents?
Mostly for medical professionals. But I know of parents that have printed that out and given it to their local GP or taken it into ED or taken it with them when they've gone in. Our local Down Syndrome Support Group, Downright Special, have attached it to the health passport that they're encouraging families to fill in.
Okay.
So it's there with stuff to information for health professionals.
Maybe we could, if we can link that to this.
Absolutely. Podcast,
you know, parents know where to find it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Amazing.
At the root of what you're talking about there in terms of the medical professions, doctors not understanding certain symptoms that are, or certain things that are being presented to then be able to make the right diagnosis, you call that something, right?
Yeah. So we talk a lot about something called diagnostic overshadowing.
Right.
And that is where somebody has a pre-existing diagnosis and then all other symptoms and signs that come along, the health professional puts down to that pre-existing diagnosis. So if you have a toddler, perhaps with Down syndrome, who appears to be floppy and appears not to be communicating, then if you don't know much about, firstly, Down syndrome, and secondly, about that individual toddler, you might just assume that, well, that's just Down syndrome, and you don't look to see what might be going on. Whereas the parent will know that actually this child is usually running around like a loon, and this is really odd for them to be so quiet and so floppy. So I think it's really important for people to remember not to jump to that first conclusion and to keep an open mind and to think what else might be going on. I think as parents, we spend all our time with our children. We know exactly when they're well, when they're not well. And even if we don't know exactly what is wrong with them, we know that something is wrong. And that is the first step to trying to get things sorted. So I think as health professionals, we need to be listening to parents.
Is that your advice, like kind of resounding advice to parents if they're struggling to get a doctor to see that, you know, this is not normal for their child, just to keep on at them and reiterating that, no, this is not what my child is normally like. There is something wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really sad again that we need to do that. But, and there shouldn't be that emphasis on parents to have to do that. But unfortunately, I think that's the only way we can get that knowledge out there.
Okay. So it would be good to just in terms of the work that you've done amazingly to try to help medical professions with diagnostic overshadowing, do you feel like they're still on that journey now to try to better improve on how they work and help parents? But more importantly, going back to what you said in your lectures, you only had one lecture on children with DS or Down syndrome in its entirety. You know, do you feel like that's even changing at all, or is anything being done on that?
I think there is a will to change now, which there wasn't before.
Fantastic.
And some really, really good organisations have taken things on board. So it's helped with things like Don't Forget the Bubbles, which is a paediatric online learning site. They're international, really, really good organisation. And they've been fabulous and have supported lots of the things that I've been doing. So with kind of popular things like that, taking things on board, I think it's really helped. We've still got some work to do with Health Education England and with medical school training. And one of the problems with that is that things are different in each medical school. There's still lots of work to be done to make things more seamless, I guess, between different sites. But there is a will to want to know more. And I think that's really important. That's got to be where things start.
Definitely. I think, yeah, so one of the things for us, the challenge that we've had as Kush has grown, has been, you know, every year he has to have bloods. When he was young, it was relatively easy. We were like, this is brilliant. He's not refusing. He's going along with it. Off he goes. You know, the doctors and nurses were like, wow, you know, 2, 3 years old, 4, off he went, blood test, prodded, poked, and he was very compliant. And we were like, fab, you know, my anxiety was through the roof, but he just didn't seem to be fazed. You know, put an iPad in front of him, It was all good. As he's grown, this has changed. He has become a lot more aware, a lot more sensitive to touch, and a lot more fearful, especially through COVID and being at home all the time. He's kind of forgotten the routine of appointments, being in hospitals, what that's like. And now, obviously, you know, we're doing lateral flows and stuff on him, left, right and centre, more because I want him to get used to it, so that, you know, we both said there will be a time where we're going to have to do a PCR or whatever. So let's make this part of his routine. Let's make it fun, as fun as you can, shoving something up your nose. But, you know, let's try. It was the same with the blood tests. So he didn't have his routine bloods for almost 18 months. And then when it came to it, I knew that he would get scared because he was getting fearful of the touch, of grip. He's very sensitive to touch, light touch. You need to grab him rather than be really soft, because then he's really hypersensitive. So I actually reached out to our community nurses and I said, he's due for bloods. I know it's not going to work first time. Is there anything you can do to help us? Because I don't want to, and we might have to going forward, but as much as we can, I don't want to have to restrain him. Because I just, if we could do it another way, why wouldn't you? So they were actually really, really good. And they said, absolutely, we'll get someone to come to you. We will practice at home with, you know, Superman or Spider-Man, whatever it was. They brought all the kit. We'll get him familiar with the kit. She said, we'll come as many times as you like. We'll make him feel like he's done the blood test at home. So then when he comes in, he's kind of be like, yeah, well, I've done that. And we did that. And the first, you know, when she came home the first time, we got through the process. You know, she came in. He's, again, very compliant. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He'll agree. He agrees to everything. But when it comes to it, he's like, no. So she sat down. She said, oh, coach, we're going to do a blood test. And he was like, yeah. And I think she thought I was mad. She thought, well, you know, he's great. He sat there and he even gave his arm. And then she touched him and he jumped and he yelped and he cried, no, no, no. And then I was almost grateful that he did that, because I thought, God, come on, Kirsch, show me up. And then she saw, and we, you know, it took a few visits. He got used to her. She said she would be there as well. He had his iPad. They numbed him. They did everything, followed the process of what we did at home, because he's very much a creature of routine. And it worked and we got the bloods. I know parents have these struggles, and I know also not all trusts are able to offer these kinds of services. You know, what else could we be doing? Or do you know of anything we could be asking for? What advice would you give?
I think that you've been incredibly lucky in what they've done with you. And you could almost have been describing Amy at that point. She loves doctors and nurses. She will put her arm out, and until you touch her, she's absolutely fine. Mm. And sadly, the last few times we have had to restrain Amy, we have had to give her a really big bear hug. Because that's been the only way we've been able to get anything done. She's not distractible in the slightest. She knows as soon as something, you know, Where's Wally book or something comes out, that something bad's going to happen.
Yeah.
And then as soon as it's finished, she's absolutely fine. She's thanking the nurses for doing horrible things to her.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of that is key. It's getting kids used to it, knowing that, yes, it's not a nice process, but it's something that will finish, that there's an end point to it. Thinking very carefully about each individual child and their sensory needs. Amy's very similar to Kush from the sounds of it, that she doesn't like light touch. It has to be something deep. Whereas other children might be different, and only parents really will know that information. Again, some children will be distractible, some won't. Mm. And it's again knowing that information. Yeah. Sometimes it's daft things, like some of the tests that we do on our kids year after year could be done by fingerprint tests, for example. And if you can get away with fingerprint test, why not? And then it's using things like the numbing cream. Even, you know, with Amy, even the numbing cream is distressing for her. She hates having it on. She will sit there and fixate on her hands whilst it's there working, and is really upset by having it there. But she's got used to the fact that having it on makes the things that come later less stressful. Mm-hmm. So getting used to the cream, getting used to the bandages, taking time as well. I think as healthcare professionals, we're often in a rush because we've got so many things to do. But if we just allocate a little bit more time, we're far more likely to be successful than trying to get through things in a rush. So it all comes back down to listening to parents again, and they know their children best. And I think just taking that time to find out a bit more about that individual child and what might work for them.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's to do with the setting as well. So if community nurses can take blood from home, that's brilliant. Mm. But going into a really scary looking clinical environment with lots of horrible machines and noises and stuff can be really unsettling. So why not take things out of that room? Why not make it quieter? Why not try to find a room that feels more comfortable and relaxing? Adapt things like position as well. So I know when I'm taking blood from children at work that for babies, I'll have them laid down. For toddlers, I'll have them on the parent's lap. Mm-hmm. For an older child, I'll have them in a certain position on a bed. So it's getting a position that works for the child, mm-hmm. and works for the clinician as well. So that everybody's comfortable and ready to get it over and done with. And it often takes a lot more people than you'd think as well. Mm-hmm. So by the time you have somebody passing bottles and things, somebody actually taking the blood, somebody helping to calm the child, you know, you need a whole team of people. It's no good one person running in when they're in the middle of two other jobs and trying to get it done. So again, it comes down to time and listening to parents.
Yeah. So Amy has autism. Tell us a little bit more about that, because I know autism presents quite differently in children who have Down syndrome, doesn't it? How did you get to the diagnosis and what led you to going down that path?
I think she was probably about 7 or 8 when we noticed that she was very different to her peers with Down syndrome. So we'd go along to the group each week and all the children would be doing various activities, but Amy just seemed different. She seemed to struggle with things a little bit more. She seemed to find it difficult to play with the other children. And she was starting to do a lot of kind of repetitive movements as well. A lot of kids with Down syndrome will have sensory issues, but her sensory issues seemed to be more distressing for her than they did for other kids. I kind of started knowing that something was different. I thought it might be autism, but I also wondered if it was something that we were doing at home. You know, you spend all your time following advice from various professionals. And I think I'd got into routines of doing lots of speech and language stuff with her when she was little and physio stuff with her. And was it my fault that she wasn't playing with other kids? Because, you know, she was my first child. We spent probably more time doing speech therapy than we did playing. So it's all these things go around in your head, don't they? And then our community paediatrician was fab. And she said, I'm going to say a word to you and you're not going to like hearing it, but I have to say it. I think she might have autism. And I was like, oh, somebody else thinks she's different too. I'm not mad.
Yeah.
It took a long time to get the formal assessment. It took about 18 months, nearly 2 years to get the formal assessment and the diagnosis. So she was about 10 when we finally heard. And I think over that period of time, I'd pretty much convinced myself anyway. So it wasn't a surprise when we got that answer.
Yeah.
Autism is made up of lots and lots of different parts to it, but the main ones tend to be social communication problems, kind of a rigidity of thought and repetitive movements, a difficulty in seeing things out of routine and needing to be in that kind of routine, and sort of a lack of imaginative play a lot of the time with many kids, and then lots of sensory issues. And she had all of those things. The social communication stuff is difficult in our kids because they tend to be more social.
Yeah.
And Amy managed really well by rehearsing things and practicing things. So she still does now, actually. She'll go up to somebody and she'll seem really sociable and she'll want to communicate and she'll want to have a conversation. And to somebody that's never met her before, that, you know, that seems completely alien compared to autism. But actually, when you listen to her, she's using repetitive sentences and she's asking the same questions of everybody. And she doesn't really listen to the answers. She'll ask everybody what their favorite food is, what pajamas they wear, you know, when they're going on holiday. And she has a list of questions that she uses as her ammunition to be able to communicate with somebody. And what she can't do is turn those questions into a conversation. So it becomes less obvious on initial meeting with Amy that she has a social communication problem. But once you spend some time with her and see her patterns of communication, it's far more obvious. So I think that's one of the areas where our children will present in a different way. The other is that because they already have a developmental delay to some extent, you don't necessarily see the signs as early as you would do in other kids.
Yeah.
And I think, again, there's a big element of diagnostic overshadowing and people thinking, well, you know, they've got Down syndrome, that's the cause. Yeah.
Right.
Whereas actually about 1 in 10 of our children will have autism.
But it's so hard because, as you were just describing there in the conversation pieces, how much of it is, you know, an inability to be able to contextualize a question and answer because of the learning disability versus actually, you know, this is autism and this is one of the markers of an autism diagnosis. And and that's just so difficult. So
absolutely. It really is. And as parents, you start again, I started thinking, well, I've taught her to say all these phrases. So is that why she's doing it?
It is
really difficult. I must say that having the diagnosis made more sense. And there were things that we altered a little bit about the way we manage things with Amy because of the autism diagnosis that have helped us since then. And to be honest, probably autism is a bigger problem for her than Down syndrome has been.
We're going down a similar path at the moment with Kush. I've had questions in my mind for a long time, haven't we? We're having conversations with, you know, the pediatrician at the moment. Now, I'm being told on one hand, why do you want to give him another label? But then on the other hand, I'm thinking, it's not, I mean, I don't care about the labels, to be honest with you. It is what it is. If getting him a formal diagnosis will help give him the support that he needs and more support, that's why I'm doing it. Other than it getting the diagnosis and it then making sense for you, how else has it helped you as a family?
I think it's been about the way... There are certain things that you will do for somebody who is autistic that we wouldn't necessarily do for somebody that has Down syndrome. And so it's all about managing things and helping her to cope. A label doesn't change who she is, but it changes the way that not only we manage things with her, but school will manage things with her. And that's been the big thing, I think. I mean, we probably would have got to the level we are at home without the label. We probably would have been planning our days and using planners and all sorts of things anyway. But school have been able to look at her as an autistic child and so use certain measures that they would use with other autistic children rather than seeing her as just a child, just a child with Down syndrome. And I think it's the fact that it opens up doors to more support and it opens up minds of people to how they can actually interact with her and support her better. It is really difficult. I mean, she already had a statement as it was then, or an EHCP. So she's not got any more hours in the day spent on her, but it's the way those hours are spent.
If you don't mind me asking, has it changed any way in terms of how you, your expectations of Amy, like in the future, in so much, you know, with Down syndrome, there's a sense that you can achieve anything you want to achieve, it will come in time. With a dual diagnosis, does that remain or does it change?
I think I've probably got two answers to that. One is that she is still Amy. She was always Amy. She will always be Amy. And Amy, like any of our kids, is an individual, and her future depends on so many things other than just who she is. But Amy's future is always going to be different to her friend's future, for example. But the thing that really hit me, especially when I was trying to convince myself that it was down to me and it was something I was doing wrong, was that this is lifelong and that she's always going to need support. And I know she always will from the Down syndrome side of things. But I was there's a tiny bit in my mind that was thinking, if it's down to me and something I've done, then I can correct it and I can make things better.
Right.
But I can't correct autism. And it took me a while to get that straight in my head and to understand that, no, I don't need to correct autism, but what I do need to do is find ways to support her. And I think compared to her peers with Down syndrome, thinking about some of the girls that we know well who are a similar age, she probably won't be as independent as they are. But who's to say she would have been anyway, even without the autism, because she's not them, she's Amy. And I think, yes, we talk a lot about the fact that there should be no limitations for our children. Unfortunately, there's limitations on all of us. And it's how we manage what life throws at us. And the way that we might manage things for somebody with Down syndrome and the way that we might manage things for somebody with autism might be different, but it's putting those together to do the best that we can for her.
When you said about 1 in 10 children with Down syndrome would have autism, I didn't realize it was so many. And I think there's a lot of talk about, you know, how some families who have a dual diagnosis feel quite underrepresented in the community. And actually, maybe it's just we're not talking about it enough.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's lovely to celebrate all the fabulous things that we do celebrate. And I don't ever want to stop seeing all this stuff on social media about how brilliant our kids can be. But sometimes I think we also need to acknowledge that sometimes things are more challenging.
Yeah.
Just like they are for anybody. You know, we all have different abilities, different strengths, different challenges, whether we have an extra chromosome or not. And I think it's okay to acknowledge that some people might find things more challenging than others. And perhaps that just gives us more opportunity to celebrate different things sometimes.
Absolutely. And but just on that, could you just tell us a little bit just in terms of what has been the biggest impact on your family since you've had the dual diagnosis? Well, it's not since you had the diagnosis, but I suppose to some extent because of Amy having autism, how has that actually impacted in terms of your family?
I think we've changed family life an awful lot. We don't do anything without a lot of planning. Amy needs to know where she's going, what's going to happen, in what order, when we're going to eat, what we're going to eat, most importantly. we need to know that things aren't going to be too noisy, that there's not going to be any sudden surprises, there's not going to be any sudden changes to the routine. We need to know that if we go somewhere, there's somewhere that she can hide if things get too much for her, and that we feel comfortable going somewhere if she's going to have a real challenge as well. And so that has really changed how we've planned days out beforehand. We'd go anywhere, we'd do anything, and 9 times out of 10, something would surprise us and we'd end up with a big meltdown. And it would be traumatic for Amy, traumatic for her brother, traumatic for us. Whereas now, yes, we still have those meltdowns, but they're not as often. And often it's over something that we probably should have picked up on and planned for beforehand. So we do an awful lot of planning, and it does worry me sometimes that Toby's missing out on things because of that.
Yeah.
So we do try and do things without Amy sometimes that Toby can access. Mm. But equally, Toby's learned so much from Amy about patience and about difference and things that his peers don't necessarily know. And he is, you know, they do fight like cat and dog sometimes, and sister, but he is really good with her. And he knows as well that things that will set her off and things that will upset her and things that will calm her, it's him that will calm her down when she is feeling anxious and stressed. So yeah, I think that's one of the big things, just that we have to plan so much more and we've had to alter how we do things as a family. Doesn't mean that we have any less of a good time. It just means that there's a lot more thought that goes into things. We're not very spontaneous.
We always end our podcast with 3 sentences that we would like you to complete.
So, I'm intrigued about this.
honestly, it's nothing. Yeah, very straightforward.
So the first one is, to a parent who may be starting their journey with a dual diagnosis, please remember
that your child is still your child. They're still an individual. They don't change because they've got a label. Some of the things that you do to help them and support them might change, but they're still them.
Amazing. And the next one is, the best thing about being Amy's mum is?
Oh, when she gives me the most huge, brilliant smiles because something has tickled her. She's got the biggest, funniest sense of humour. And it doesn't always come out because she can be quite anxious and stressed about things. But when it does, it's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
And the last one, to any doctors listening, from a fellow doctor and mother to a child with complex needs, the next time you're examining or assessing a young person with additional needs, please don't
make assumptions. Please remember that you don't know everything about this child in front of you, and that's okay. But listen to the parents. Take a bit of extra time, find out what you can about this child and about what makes them different, and you'll get the right answer for your patient.
Brilliant. Amazing. Thank you so much.
You've been so wonderful.
My pleasure.
It's been really nice. Thank you.
Thank you both ever so much for inviting me.
Coffee and Chromosomes is brought to you by the charity Wouldn't Change a Thing, creating a world where negative perceptions of Down syndrome are a thing of the past. If you'd like to hear about a particular topic or from a certain individual, email us at podcast@wouldn'tchangeathing.org.